Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. We have another episode of the podcast for you today. We're going to be talking about COVID and the COVID epidemic, unsurprisingly. Also, this weird combination of federal law enforcement slash election campaign actions coming out of the Department of Homeland Security and the Justice Department. And it's pretty hard to disentangle which is which. I mean, my sense is that it's heavily electoral. And I noticed I guess a lot has happened even this morning. We are recording this at noon, a little after noon on Wednesday, July 29th, 2020. And this morning, President Trump did one of his, you know, kind of brief press availabilities and basically said, you know, it's up to the Oregon folks to get Portland in line, or we're going to have to go in there and clean it out, you know, kind of settle this once and for all. And then, like, what, an hour later, the governor of Oregon goes on Twitter and says, yeah, I just talked to Mike Pence, and they're pulling out the federal forces. So, like, what? You know, what happened there? And then I think there was just and Matt, our colleague Matt, who's joining us today, Kate Riga, is on vacation. I would think we'll probably talk about this. They just announced that basically the, you know, federal troops, federal forces being sent into major swing state cities in the Rust Belt. What is it? Wisconsin, Michigan. What are those three they just announced?
It was Milwaukee, Cleveland, and Detroit, I believe. Although the White House sort of announced them last week without meaning to, so we can get into that.
Right. So I guess, and it does it certainly seems like the idea is you send in, I don't know exactly which agency they're sending in, but you send in federal officers to kind of drum up a sense of dangerous, out of control cities to kind of push the suburbs in swing states back into the Republican column. Whether that works or not, who knows? But we're going to talk about that. Before we say any more, we are going to, you know, it's funny, David. I got all queued up here with my Grady's Cold Brew coffee sponsorship ad copy. And then just as we were getting started, I was like, oh, I got to clean off my desktop here in front of the computer and kind of shut a few browsers. So I looked up to find the copy, and it was the browser was closed. But I'm really quick on my feet, so I got it here. Grady's Cold Brew is here to help you stay cool and caffeinated this summer with their signature New Orleans-style iced coffee. If you're still holed up at home, Grady's can bring the coffee shop to you. Their line of brew-it-yourself bean bags ship directly to your door for less than a buck cup. And the system couldn't be easier to use. I know this from personal experience. It's really that easy. Just add water to the pre-measured filter bags for gallons of completely customizable cold brew. No special equipment required, and shipping's free on all Grady's bean bag products. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 20% off your first order at Grady'sColdBrew.com with promo code TPM. And remember, you can pick it up at your local grocery store or at Amazon.com. So, David, what are we doing?
Well, before we go on to the main topics, I actually noticed New York Magazine gave Grady's a shout out for its ingenious design. They were doing a series of posts on kind of products, or, you know, they have kind of a little shopping affiliate.
Oh, right. Interesting.
Affiliate site called The Strategist, and they featured the brew it, like the bean bag.
Oh, the bag inside the bag thing. Well, I think I remember when we had got, it was probably like a year ago now, we actually had Grady, and there is a Grady. This isn't just like a kind of a focus grouped, you know, kind of right. faux founder. There really is a Grady. And Grady was saying that I guess they were the first, you know, iced coffee, cold brew iced coffee vendor to come up with this, you know, bean bag system. Now, obviously, the idea that you soak coffee grounds is not, you know, people have done that for some time, but basically packaging it that way where it's all kind of, you know, kind of done in a certain way. You do it yourself without a lot of contraptions and stuff. That they were the first ones to have that. And I guess everybody else has, or all the other vendors have kind of jumped in. But I know he was pretty pretty proud of that innovation in the cold brew iced coffee
exactly.
space.
I mean, it really is as simple as just pouring water. So, you know, if you haven't tried it out, definitely worth a shot.
Yep.
So, on to the news. Matt, just before we signed on to record, some news out of Congress regarding the coronavirus. Representative Louie Gohmert from Texas has tested positive, and this comes after the congressman has perpetually refused to wear a mask on Capitol Hill. It seems like, you know, the mask wearing in Congress is hit or miss. On the Senate side, it seems like people are, you know, follow the rules pretty closely, a bit less so on the House side, with some Trump allies refusing to cover their faces in the halls of Congress. Gohmert is one of those who has not worn a mask in public. In fact, he was at the House Judiciary Committee hearing with Bill Barr yesterday, walked in behind the Attorney General, maskless. You had just put together kind of a post looking at all the various things he said on the coronavirus in the kind of weeks and months leading up to today. What can you share some of the greatest hits with our listeners?
Yeah, unfortunately, I've gotten really good at this over these past few weeks. Of something happens, and then you go back through that person or that publication or that conspiracy theory movement's history of COVID denial. And the congressman, you know, he's not denied that the virus exists, but pretty early on, he's kind of dismissed it's the threat of its spread, and he's sort of minimized its effects on people. He was actually involved in one of the earliest COVID exposures that made the news. I'm not sure if you remember the Conservative Political Action Conference, where there was a staffer backstage who was later diagnosed with COVID, and a few lawmakers, I think Mark Meadows, at that point, who was the incoming White House Chief of Staff, chose to quarantine or minimize their public appearances. And Gohmert was one that said, nope, I'm going to keep doing, Capitol building tours for hundreds of people. He was kind of just raged forward. And it's been going on like that ever since, even though, again, he was one of the earliest exposures to make the news. In April, he claimed that there was a mist in Germany that could kill the virus for 2 weeks. Anything that comes in contact with this mist, he said, will be killed for 2 weeks.
Like a mist that someone had created, or kind of like a fog had come in and all the COVID was going away.
He was making a reference to a product that he said was being developed in Arizona. And I don't think that's actually ever been determined that product even existed. But then in an interview, he compared it to a product that he said existed in Germany, where, you know, a nurse who's all in scrubs would go into a tent and they get sprayed with a mist, and now they're basically COVID-proof. And PolitiFact at the time got in touch with a public health officials in Germany who were like, no, nothing like that exists. A COVID spokesperson said at the time that, you know, PolitiFact wasn't acting honorably, and the congressman will show proof of his claim on his own time and so on. And I don't think anything ever came of that. Just one in a number. He supports defunding the World Health Organization. He pushed on April 23rd to reopen Texas because, quote, we're social animals. And of course, Texas did reopen a week later. And we know what happened after that. There was a subsequent spike in the case. David said, he's been one of these members of Congress who's kind of stubbornly refused to wear a mask. He's worn masks in committee meetings where Democratic chairs have required them. But wasn't for example, there,
wasn't there wasn't there one hearing where he actually got an argument over it though? Am I confusing him with someone else? I don't want to distract you from your line of thought. But I thought there was one case. But you know, maybe it was another kind of rep from this kind of political space who kind of banged his shoe on the table metaphorically about having to wear a mask or something.
Right. I know Gohmert did tell CNN, I think in June, that one of the reasons he wasn't wearing a mask is because he said he was tested frequently for COVID and that if he does come down with the virus, he'll be all about masks. So I guess now time will tell if that bears
true.
Yeah,
I mean, that was the main thing that I found on him talking about his mask policy.
I may have been thinking of something else. Yeah. It's also just for our listeners to know, this is potentially a serious situation. I think he's 66 years old. I don't know his current health condition pre-COVID, but obviously people over 65, it's for real. I assume at the moment he is either asymptomatic or just mildly symptomatic since he was just tested. Do we know his current condition? I guess he was up there yesterday, so he must have been asymptomatic or not very symptomatic as recently as yesterday.
I know that Jake Sherman of Politico, who was I think the reporter who broke this news initially, had tweeted just before we came on to record that Gohmert actually told his staff in person today that he contracted coronavirus. So he must not be feeling too poorly, I guess, in order, to be able to share that news generously in person with his colleagues.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
I don't think he's commented on his specific condition though yet. We just have a confirmation that he's confirmed positive.
To your point, Josh, about the potential severity. I mean, look at Herman Cain, who tested positive for coronavirus. He was at Trump's rally in Tulsa in late June, and I think he was hospitalized maybe on July 1st or 2nd.
Yeah,
and his office, yeah. I mean, his Twitter account announced today Herman Cain is still in the hospital receiving oxygen treatment. So that's, several weeks after that initial news. So,
and the other thing, I mean, we don't know his condition, but I will point out that the tweet on his account that was, obviously by people acting on his behalf, giving an update, spoke very vaguely about being, treated with oxygen. And they certainly didn't say he was on a ventilator. And hopefully he's not, since obviously that's a very bad place to get for an older person on COVID. But It sounded like that might be a way to refer to mechanical ventilation. I mean, obviously a lot of people just get the little kind of face mask, with supplemental oxygen to kind of keep their oxygenation levels a little higher, but that didn't sound great. And for a man, I think in his mid-70s who, survived cancer some years ago, for a month, that's bad. And that made me kind of a little skeptical that he's just, he's been in the hospital for a month and he's just getting, kind of supplemental oxygen. Again, the kind of thing I think most of us know where you get the little, transparent mask that just kind of ups the concentration of oxygen as opposed to mechanical ventilation. So it is, I mean, we know this. It's serious stuff. It's particularly serious if you are a senior. So, notwithstanding his irresponsible behavior and talk, we obviously wish him the best because it's a serious thing. He's got family like the rest of us.
Absolutely.
The one thing on, sorry to interrupt, but the one thing on Gohmert, and just to underline that, we don't cover stuff like this to make light of people's situations, but he has been a leading voice against
keeping people healthy.
Proxy voting in particular.
Oh, right.
He gave a speech that he compared it to, people in the Spanish flu and people in the Civil War. They didn't complain about being afraid. They didn't have these wishy-washy concerns of dying, I think is how he put it. So it's in the context of him urging and voting for his fellow lawmakers to be there with him while he's maskless that we're reporting on all of this.
And I think, you know, one thing we definitely need to, you know, collectively get away from is that this isn't a matter of like personal bravery. We're trying to make a disease. We're trying to make fewer people get the disease because that disease in the population has all sorts of negative effects. It keeps the economy from running at a good level. It costs huge amounts of money. It causes immense levels of personal suffering, both direct and indirect. So this is, you know, you may be, you know, kind of so balls up, you don't care about getting, you know, bitten in half by a shark. Great. But that's really not the point. It's not about personal bravery. It's about acting in a way that doesn't, you know, screw things up for everybody else. And that really is, you know, the kind of the non-mask thing. That's really kind of what that's about, right? Kind of it's just about me. I can't manage this really minor inconvenience to just keep everybody else healthy.
Yeah. Josh, I wanted to touch next on a post that you wrote late last week looking at why New York's numbers have remained so low as, you know, cases explode in other parts of the country. Obviously, this is something of a reversal from the spring when New York was really the kind of global epicenter for the virus. And now, from the numbers I've seen over the last few days, our positivity testing is in about like 1%, sometimes a little less, sometimes a little more.
Yeah, I actually just, as we were recording, the daily numbers come out around noon in New York every day, and they actually show up first in a kind of a limited form on the governor's Twitter account, and then they you know show up on the portals a short time later. So today, or you know, reporting today, there were 715 new cases, which is they range for almost 2 months now. They have ranged anywhere from in the 500s to like the 900s. And as you said, just under 1% or just over 1%, occasionally getting up to like, you know, 1.3 or 1.4%. Actually, today it's 1.14%. So that's a little higher. And it's always a little, you know, you never want to see it even nudge up a speck. But that's well within the band that it has oscillated within, again, basically going back from to early June.
And remind us, in places like Arizona, Florida, Texas, what are the positivity rates in those states? 15 up to sometimes closer to 20%?
Yeah, I mean, they bounce all over the place, but they are routinely in the upper teens and occasionally even get over 20, depending on the state. And the funny thing, you know, one of the you know, slices of this story that you may not know about unless you kind of really, you know, get deep into it, is that the states that are, you know, that were very pro reopening, kind of the more Trump driven states, have a lot of ways, without necessarily faking the numbers, presenting the numbers in less worrisome ways. And a number of the states that are currently hard hit, Texas, Florida, Arizona, they have their own ways of measuring test positivity. So, for instance, in Florida, what test positivity means is, what is the percentage of the tests that you gave that came back positive? Now, when we get these daily reports, that does not mean that every test reported was given yesterday or every positive that is reported came back positive yesterday. It kind of, you know, there's reporting lags and everything, but it all kind of comes out in the wash. And so what you do is you divide one from the other. And in Florida, they have their own proprietary formula that they don't share that generates a much lower positivity rate. So Florida, if you go onto their site on any given day, it will often say something like 10 or 11%, where if you just do the math yourself, it's like 18 or 19 or 20%. And what they say that formula is that they are removing people who have tested a bunch of times, because that kind of doesn't count. And public health people would have a better sense of, well, does that make any sense? Does that, you know, is that meaningful? My sense is it, you know, it might be. It's there's some logic to that. But that's not how everybody else is doing it. And generally the states that are being most aggressive just give you that division. So they come up with these ways to kind of massage the numbers and oh, we're going to do it this way, do it that way. I think the most important thing is just that when you have all these like proprietary formulas, not only is that a little questionable, it makes it impossible to have an apples to apples comparison. So right. when we do it, we just do, you know, divide one from the other. And yes, they, so basically in states like Florida, Texas, you know, Arizona, those numbers can be as high as 20 times higher, the positivity percentage,
right,
than they are in New York at the moment.
And tell us why, you know, what did you conclude? Why do you think the numbers are staying so low in New York compared to other places that are still surging around the country?
Well, I think the key question is it that we are just doing a great job and we're doing really aggressive mitigation and we're sort of, you know, kicking butt and keeping the numbers really low? Or does the fact that we had this horrific outbreak a few months ago and the best estimates, again, with pretty widespread serology testing, suggest that, you know, 20% of the people in New York City got COVID, even if maybe they didn't know it in every case that they got COVID. So that's a lot of people. That's not what we traditionally think of as herd immunity. But that almost certainly has some incremental impact, right? Every fifth person isn't a vector, can't be a transmitter. So there's some friction that must create in the transmission of COVID, but we don't know how much. There are other unique things about New York City. New York City has far and away the highest population density of any city in the United States, like twice as high as the next highest. We also have the subway. So we have a lot of good ways to transmit the disease. So which is it? We don't really know. My own sense is that it is mainly just really aggressive mitigation and not reopening that quickly. One thing that seems probative to me is that in upstate New York, which from the perspective of New York City can mean everything from like the counties right outside of New York City, you know, all the way up to, you know, Vermont, a lot of those areas had very low levels of COVID during March and April, but they're down at comparable levels to New York City. So having a massive outbreak does not seem to have been necessary there to keep the numbers down. What in the post you're talking about, the point I made was this, that we are all, the three of us, I think, are all in different parts of New York City at the moment. And you go outside New York City and like pretty much everyone's wearing a mask. They may not be wearing it right. You see people with it kind of pulled down past their chin, you know, when they're walking on the sidewalk. But I would say that it is certainly 90% of people I see in just sort of like, you know, sidewalk traffic, people walking around, have a mask on their body, right? It may not be pulled up all the way. Mostly it is, but there's a lot of masks. And when I talk to people who like, say, live in Washington, D.C., people say like, you know, everybody's wearing masks here too, Josh, but our cases are substantially higher. So it can't just be that. But I think the thing is that, especially in the absence of strong messaging and leadership from the very top, i.e. the federal government, you really cannot underestimate the behavior shaping impact of a cataclysm the way that New York, especially New York City and the New York City metro area, had in March and April. People remember it. People remember everybody getting sick and the constant sirens and people dying. And you know, you experience that and people are like, I don't want to get sick. And I don't want to go back to that, what we had. Even if I don't get sick, I don't want to, you know, be trapped in my house and all that kind of stuff. And I just think that my sense is that a significant part of the equation is that chastening, horrifying experience has just shaped behavior in this area in depth in a way that is hard to quite quantify. It's not just a matter of the percentage of people you see walking on the street that have a mask, or, you know, are your bars open and stuff like that. So it's the truth is we don't know. It's some mix of those, and we're so divided as a country. Sometimes these discussions kind of devolve into sort of, you know, one-upsmanship, you know, who's doing better, who's this and that. But it's really not that. It's important to know, because if you can keep it at these levels, you want to know how to do it. You know, it's kind of a bummer if it is some kind of very low level of herd immunity, since the costs of getting, you know, of getting 20 or 25% of people sick are horrendous. If you can do it with just aggressive mitigation, we need to get that word out, because then you can kind of open up the economy and then everybody can, you know, live semi-normal lives. And my sense is, at least, we have tons of evidence from around the world that aggressive mitigation can do it. Because the reality is that in all sorts of parts of the world, in wealthy industrialized countries that have the kind of the state capacity and economic capacity to do it, they have super low rates. And even when they say they have, oh, we've got a new flare up, we've got a new outbreak. Like I think I did a post on this yesterday. People have likely heard, like, there's a new outbreak in Hong Kong. Their case numbers are going up in Japan. There's some surge of new cases in Germany. But when you look at the numbers, they are talking about worrisome surges that make them clamp back down, where the numbers are like a fraction of what they even are in New York. So we're so far gone that, you know, what we think is like, hey, New York's doing great, they see is like a new outbreak. So it's a hard set of questions to make sense of. A lot of these things are unknown, certainly especially unknown for those of us who aren't experts, but even for the experts, since we don't know a lot about the disease. But getting a handle of it is a big deal, and not just bragging rights, because we need to find out what to do and then make sure everybody's doing it to keep, yeah, you know, keep the economy going, keep us healthy and all that.
Yeah. I mean, in the meantime, I guess just keep wearing your mask, right? I've found those blue paper masks are kind of the best ones for breathability in the subtropical climate that New York City now finds itself in.
And just being, able to, just being able to throw it away,
yeah,
too, you know, kind of after you use it. I mean, we've ordered like a bunch of them for our family, because once you, you know, you can get a little obsessive about it with the cloth mask, because you're not supposed to just like put on the mask, take it off, you know, kind of throw it on your pillow when you're sleeping. The idea is you're supposed to take it off and like carefully take it off and wash it and stuff. And yeah, with those blue ones, you just like, you know, you just toss them. They're
no big deal.
Costs like 30 cents a piece or something.
Yeah. All right. So switching gears a little bit, Matt, I wanted to talk about some of the reporting you've done lately. We hinted at this at the beginning of the show around this, I totally blanked on the name. Operation Legend, is that what it's called?
That's right, yeah.
Yes, Operation Legend. This federal deployment of law enforcement in multiple cities across the country. Kansas City, Albuquerque, Milwaukee, Chicago. Obviously, Portland is where the most attention has been received. But the operation there, I guess, is a little bit different than what this nationwide effort is. Tell us about kind of how these various American mayors found out about federal law enforcement coming into their towns, how they're dealing with it, what should people know about what's happening right now?
Yeah, so first, I'm going to split it up into what's happening in Portland and Seattle, which is called Diligent Valor. That's the DHS name for it.
Diligent what?
Diligent Valor. And that's what the administration says is sort of the mob violence, riot control. It's they're sending federal agents to protect federal buildings. Although, as we've written, a lot of times these federal agents go well outside the federal property that they're there to protect. And then outside of Seattle and Portland, we have something called Operation Legend, which was announced earlier this month starting in Kansas City. And then last week it was expanded to Chicago and Albuquerque. At the same time, the White House sort of let slip in an email that it was going to be expanded to Milwaukee, Detroit, and Cleveland. And the Justice Department made that official today. And so the Portland and Seattle operations, the government says, are mostly about protecting federal buildings. Operation Legend is mostly led by the Justice Department, and they're saying it's about fighting violent crime, prosecuting gun cases and drug cases and gang cases. You know, kind of the tough on crime thing that Bill Barr has made a career out of for decades.
Conventional street crime versus Antifa militias. Right. Yeah.
But one of the problems the administration has had is they haven't communicated the differences between these programs effectively. So last week when they announced that this was going to be expanded to five cities, people in those five cities were saying, wait, you're going to send agents to throw us into unmarked vans in Albuquerque? You know, the protests in Detroit aren't really that violent. Why do we need anything like the Portland situation here in Detroit? And the reason for that is the federal government barely coordinated with mayors and police chiefs in these cities. As I wrote in what we published this morning, you know, the mayor of Kansas City was caught off guard because that's the first city in this program that was announced on July 8th. Basically, a staffer in his office the previous day had sort of spoken back and forth with the local U.S. attorney about maybe, you know, having some more federal assets in the city. And then the very next day, it was a Justice Department press release about a major law enforcement initiative. It was in a White House press briefing. And the mayor found out about it on Twitter. He thought they were going to be planning this. He didn't really know. You know, he had this vague notion that the feds were going to get involved in crime fighting in his city. And even after that sort of embarrassing thing where the mayor didn't know that he was the home city of this major federal operation, 2 weeks later, we have this expansion announcement, and the mayors and police chiefs in those five cities had no idea, or, you know, basically no idea that they were going to be involved. And so in at least two cities, and I've spoken to people who think it's more than that, that the operation is basically a recasting of another operation called Relentless Pursuit, which was announced in December. And the outlines of the two of them are basically the same, that they're gonna, the Justice Department is gonna dump a bunch of money and dump a bunch of FBI agents and ATF resources and marshals into these cities to try to basically goose the violent crime prosecutions. So because there was so little information shared with these local cities, it comes off as kind of political because it comes off as sort of a federal government effort that has, it's supposed to make the crime situation in these cities better, and yet there's been pretty minimal coordination.
Let me ask you, Matt, is it whether it's really a misunderstanding? Because my sense of this has been, but as you say, or as I'm learning, you know, there was a version of this they had back in December, you know, long before George Floyd's murder and long before COVID and everything we're dealing with now, that it seems to me that they really are the same thing in as much as creating this narrative of, you know, cities out of control, Trump needs to go in and, you know, bust heads, and that they have different sort of premises, you know, kind of theories of the case that they can apply in different contexts. In these cases where you've got, like, you know, kind of constant protests and sort of, you know, kind of low-level vandalism and you know, kind of street fighting near federal buildings, they have this kind of DHS angle. You know, we have jurisdiction to police federal properties, and kind of like maybe you threw a rock at the federal property and we're going to catch up with you, you know, later in the evening at your house when you're having dinner. So, okay, so that's one thing. And then in these other areas where they don't really have that, it's just, you know, kind of general federal law enforcement where there is, you know, it's kind of complicated because, you know, kind of ordinary crimes are basically a state and local jurisdiction, but, you know, there's DEA and there, you know, so is it a misunderstanding or is it, you know, that in reality, it kind of is all part of the same thing. And there's just sort of different flavors they're applying in different areas.
Right. Right. The White House has, if they haven't mistakenly made it seem like the same thing, they've purposefully tried to create this image that these cities have run rampant with crime. And, you know, that Portland is the same thing as Milwaukee, and what they really need is more FBI in their city. For example, the city of Milwaukee said they only realized that they were part of the discussion about this crime-fighting initiative because Mark Meadows mentioned them in an interview. And in that interview, he said he put Portland right alongside Milwaukee, right alongside, you know, other cities in the quote-unquote heartland or whatever, as places that needed federal help. So, you know, Bill Barr has tried to differentiate them. He said this one's a classic crime fighting in his words, and the Portland and Seattle operations are about mob violence. But obviously the president has said all these cities in the same breath, you know, so they need to be dominated and under control and so on. Mark Meadows has. And I do want to distinguish between Operation Legend and Operation Relentless Pursuit. A few months ago, I spoke with people in the Kansas City mayor's office who said that operation in December, the crime fighting one, was the product of a few months of planning. And they kind of went back and forth with the federal government about what was needed and what could be achieved and so on. And then to have it relaunched on a day's notice under a different name at the same time that the president is spouting off about how all these liberal cities are out of control, that's when it became for them overtly political, that they would take this carefully planned you know, operation that was meant to go after gun crimes and murders and federal offenses and turn it into something overnight that was about a White House event, basically.
This is what I wanted to ask you. Usually when there are these kinds of things with the federal government, you know, federal law enforcement, the baseline is that someone kills someone in a city, that's the local police force does with that. You got a local DA. And normally when you have the feds coming in, it's because maybe there's, you know, a certain city has become a transshipment point for drug smuggling, or there is an outburst of gun crimes. And so, you know, since things cross jurisdictions, you need, you know, you're focusing on guns. What was the focus of what was happening in December?
Right. Well, I mean, it's pretty close to what this Operation Legend, the missions are pretty close. So I'll read from the Operation Legend announcement today, because like I said, it's pretty much the same thing, where they said they're going to be focusing on combating violent gangs, gun crime, and drug trafficking organizations. So there are federal laws that come into play when you're talking about gun offenses, gang violence, drug trafficking. And the federal government's approach here is basically going after those federal crimes as a way to impact local criminal violence. So obviously, there's a decades-long history of especially sort of law and order Republicans using those type of tactics to really tamp down on cities and to fuel the sort of incarceration machine and so on. But that was the message in December, and that was the message this month, where sort of out of the blue, they re-announced this program.
Well, you know, before Antifa or Antifa, I'm sort of sliding into President Trump's pronunciation. Before Antifa was his big bugaboo, his thing was MS-13, this Central American, you know, origins in Central America, criminal gangs, you know, extortion, drugs, all that kind of stuff. It does, you know, somewhat like Antifa, it does exist, but it has, you know, been made into sort of like a sort of a racist, you know, kind of scare thing. Now, so my question is it the case that you know, drug smuggling or gun crimes were going up in Kansas City? Was something happening? You know, generally speaking, there was this pretty small rise in crime in certain areas in the country in 2015, 2016. Generally speaking, crime is at very low levels kind of everywhere in the country. At least it was until, you know, a month or two ago. So was there like an outbreak that there was some rationale that they needed to kind of up things, or was this just, you know, kind of sort of a continuation of Trump's, you know, MS-13 thing?
Yeah, I it's hard to call anything a spike or an outbreak, but there has been a slight increase in violent crime, and specifically violent crime, not all crime, and not specifically in liberal cities. You know, there are Republican-led cities in the country where this has taken place as well. And I think if you asked local leadership, they welcome federal help when it comes to that sort of thing. Even, you know, Democratic mayors, when it comes to crime and it comes to their constituents, are pretty open to accepting, especially in Chicago, for example, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. They welcome that. I got a letter from the mayor of Chicago to the president who said, if you want to help us enforce gun laws, bring in more U.S. attorney staff, bring in ATF resources. And so they're open to that kind of thing. It's hard to say that it's any kind of like landmark year for crime. Although in these past few months, I think between like the economic devastation of this virus and just the sort of craziness of everyone staying locked up at home, there's a little trend, but nothing like the White House has made it out to be. And that's where I think, again, the politics comes into play of trying to say, the president and the FBI and the DOJ are the last line of defense between you and anarchy. You
know, right. I mean, Trump is
the message.
Trump tweets law and order every other tweet, basically, right? He says he's going to protect suburban moms, things like that. He's using all of these,
and
all these
people,
quivers in his, arrows in his quiver, yeah.
And if you wanted to fight crime, there is a way to do that with a federal-local partnership, but it's not by announcing it without them knowing. You know, you could have undercover federal and undercover local agents, one of them selling drugs to the other one without knowing they're undercover. You know, you have to coordinate these sort of things or else it doesn't really work.
One thing, this is something that I have been I have wanted to get a better handle on. There's certainly a lot of discussion over the last, you know, 8 weeks or so that, you know, in the aftermath of the George Floyd protests, that, you know, violent crime is spreading rapidly and stuff, and I do see statistics from New York City, from other cities, where they talk about these you know, very big spikes in shootings, and I assume that is accurate as far as it goes. Shootings are a very, you know, particular thing. It doesn't necessarily, you know, there are shootings, no one gets killed. Sometimes no one even gets hurt, right? Or seriously hurt. So you don't know exactly what that means. My sense is that it has gone up to some extent. And as you say, I think a lot of that is there was a lot of just commotion and unrest, and, you know, with the protests, even if it wasn't, you know, caused by them per se. And you have another aspect of, you know, people have been locked in their houses for 3 or 4 months, and that just, that has an effect on behavior. So it's not surprising if you would have an uptick, but you want to kind of go in a little more granularly and say, okay, week by week, let's look at robberies, let's look at burglaries, let's look at assaults, let's look at murders. You know, are they going up in a kind of a significant way? And I have not, I mean, some, you know, in some cases, you know, George Floyd, I believe, died something like on May 25th, I believe, more or less. So it's basically 8 weeks ago, or, you know, 8 or 9 weeks ago. And things don't get reported instantly. They certainly don't get sort of reported up to the federal government until a long time later. So it's a little hard to say, but I'm just interested to know more. And I would say this, you know, as some listeners know, my family and I were outside of New York City, you know, about an hour outside of New York City for the first, you know, we left not long after the lockdown started, and we're out of the city for, you know, about 8 weeks. And when we came back, what I certainly noticed was, you know, streets that normally you'd walk through and you're kind of like, okay, you know, everybody's around and you feel safe because place is packed and everything. Suddenly, like, it's not packed, and like the people you see kind of like, look a little, what are you up to, you know, because sort of, you know, at a certain level, why aren't you inside? Everybody's getting sick, right? So there, it's just a little weird, right? A kind of an eerie sort of feeling. And some of that is just that, I mean, I one thing, and some of this is just our perceptions, that I think one of the impacts on this city is that the homeless, and often homeless who have chronic mental illnesses had no place to go. So suddenly you have, you know, like just that population on the street. And it may be unfair and a negative thing that that can seem a little, you know, strange to people. Not that it should. Maybe, you know, I want to emphasize what we, I think most of us know, that the vast majority of homeless people with chronic mental illnesses, they're not hurting anybody. They're suffering themselves. Still, it can create an eerie feeling if those are the only people who are out on the street. So, you know, that changed. And I think another thing is that I suspect there was an effort to bring people out of shelters because shelters are not safe. You know, it's safer for people to be out of the shelters in COVID terms. So that's happening again. I do think in New York City, you've got some level of a kind of a police semi, you know, intentional slowdown, you know, their kind of politics and everything. Police would say, hey, we're getting mixed messages. Suddenly we're not supposed to arrest anybody. We can't get physical with the bad guys and all this kind of stuff. But all these things together, and especially just the impact of everybody being in their homes, that makes people, you know, we are animals, right? You contain the energy too much, people, the tempers flare. So all these things, it seems logical to me and not terribly worrisome, assuming we're not going to be on, you know, kind of in COVID lockdown forever, that you are going to have a kind of, you know, some level of uptick in violent behavior. But people create narratives for all sorts of reasons that are not really based on hard data or things that are real. And so I suspect that it's happening at a certain level, but it is being politicized in questionable ways.
That last point is what I've tried to drive at when I'm looking at these questions, acknowledging that there's been a spike in some cities and some circumstances in violent crime and shootings and so on. But then there's this immediate diagnosis. For example, Bill Barr, during the Justice Department event announcing this expansion, said he referred to George Floyd's the police killing of George Floyd as that terrible event in Minneapolis, and then said right after that we had this extreme reaction that has demonized police and called for the defunding of police departments. And what we have seen then is a significant increase in violent crime in many cities, and this rise is a direct result of the attack on the police forces and the weakening of police forces. So immediately from the White House, any motion toward a protest movement for social justice is to pin any subsequent criminal activity on that protest movement. There's a quote we used in an article a couple weeks ago about the Ferguson effect, which is the same thing that happened during the Ferguson unrest a few years ago, was that any violent crime after the fact was authorities said, because police were drawing back from their work. There was a paper by a criminologist and sociologist that found the national discourse surrounding the Ferguson effect is long on anecdotes and short on data. And so I love that quote, because in order for us to understand what's going on now, it's going to take months and years of study. And certainly, if you're trying to goose numbers to fit a preconceived notion of cause and effect here, the thing you would do was surge a bunch of FBI agents to make arrests on things like, you know, being a drug user illegally in possession of a weapon, which was one of these Operation Legend arrests. So the cause and effect is really muddy. And I think one of the purposes of this operation, especially of sort of rebooting it, like Bill Barr said the other day, is to show something to the president and to his electorate that, yes, there's something to worry about. And you wouldn't believe what'll happen if Joe Biden gets in office and takes these people out of Milwaukee or Detroit or any other city.
I would say if people get a chance to see the video of the statement the Bill Barr statement that Matt just read, it's really something, because he kind of, it's not quite captured in the words that he's talking about. Crime was going up under Obama, and he tries to like run past his momentary reference to George Floyd. He's like, you know, crime was going up, and then there was this really unfortunate incident in Minneapolis, and all of a sudden everybody hates the police, and this and that, you know, like he couldn't even rest with it for a moment in his speech. He just wanted to kind of get past it as a kind of an incident, something that doesn't really have anything to do with anything, just the kind of a little incident that along the way that happened, and we need to mention it. But the real issue is demonizing the police, and as you say, this is always the and the reality is we don't know the effect of these things. One of the things that has always worried me about the, you know, multi-decade decline in crime that really goes back to about 1990, even though people only really kind of recognized it by the mid-90s, is that we really do not know why it happened. And the conventional explanation is, well, we got CompStat and we locked people up and there was, you know, kind of more innovative kinds of policing or more aggressive policing. But the reality, I mean, I've studied this in some depth, and the reality is it's pretty clearly not about policing. Now, police obviously don't want to hear that, because even if you take out all the negative things, people work hard. They, you know, want to know they're making a difference. And I'm sure they are making a difference, but they were trying to make a difference in the 80s too, right? And they were trying to make a difference in the 70s. And we don't know, and not knowing, you know, it's kind of back to like, you know, COVID mitigation, that if you don't, you want to know what works and what doesn't, because then you can keep doing it. And if you don't know, it could just kind of come back again. And as much as obviously we don't want violent crime, because we don't want people to be victimized, and we also don't want people rotting in prisons. But another really big reason is that it is almost an absolute in human history. If you want to bring the right to power in a society, have a lot of violent crime. It is like the surest thing in the world. So people who believe in progressive politics and a more equitable society, a more humane society, actually have the deepest investment in keeping crime low, keeping a feeling of general safety in society, because that's when just, you know, humans are more inclined to create societies that are more humane and more just. And, you know, you start having lots of murders and lots of, you know, burglaries and all that kind of stuff, people will start thinking like, well, if we have to lock up a lot of people, you know, that's, you know, kind of too bad. And death penalty may not, you know, may be kind of harsh, but like, I need to feel safe in my home. So if, again, people who believe in progressive politics, who believe in a more humane society, have a deep interest in understanding what keeps levels of violence and crime low, because it's almost close to being a prerequisite for progressive governance.
Yeah. And Matt, we'll have to have you back on, keep us posted on how these, you know, deployments of force, how it goes, and, you know, any flare-ups that our listeners should know about.
Yeah, so definitely.
Keep us posted for sure. But I think that's about all the time we have this week.
Yeah, remember, Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee is a sponsor of the Josh Marshall Podcast. You can order it at gradyscoldbrew.com. If it's your first time ordering, you get 20% off by using the promo code TPM, and you can, you know, pick it up at your grocery or on amazon.com.
Sounds good. See you guys next week.
Cool. Later.
All right. Take care. Bye.